Welcome, everyone. I'm William Bloom, and this Compassion Dialogue is with Az Goodweather and Fiona Heckles, the Seed Sisters. Welcome, Kaz. Welcome, Fiona. Thank you very much for being with us. Now, before properly introducing you, a few words about this series of dialogues. It's hosted by the Spiritual Companions Trust. We're a UK educational charity, and we develop resources for people who are spiritual, but not necessarily religious. And in all these dialogues, our purpose is to explore what influences, motivates, and inspires influential spiritual authors, teachers, and activists, and hopefully inspire you too. More love, more compassion, more consciousness. Coming up in a couple of weeks, I'll be talking with Mark Silver. Mark is the only business coach I know who genuinely integrates spirituality and compassion with running a successful business. And over the decades, I recommended him to many of my friends and colleagues. Okay, and now to these two incredibly beautifully dressed and very interesting herbalists, healers, and educators, Fiona and Kaz. They founded the education group Sensory Solutions, and their books include Sensory Herbal Handbook and Poison Prescriptions, which is very, very beautifully produced and designed. Nice, nice one. And for me, what's particularly special about you two is that your science and your clinical care are rigorous, impeccable, and you also commune with nature spirits. That's a great mixture. So I'd like to start by asking each of you, and you're going to have to fight it out between yourselves as to who goes first, but I imagine you're well used to that. What was your childhood like? What were your parents like? And what was going on in your childhood that led you into this calling? Okay.
Yes. So hi, everyone. Thanks for having us. It's lovely to be here. So we actually feel really blessed because we didn't have to have that epiphany moment of, ooh, nature's alive, ooh, we're part of nature, because we were both brought up extremely close to nature. I was brought up, I lived in Newcastle in the city, but I spent a lot of my time and most of my weekends in the Lake District in a knacky old caravan. And my dad was a great adventurer and would take us out into the wilds and have us climbing Scarfell Pike at the age of 8 and in the deep snow and jumping into rivers and climbing over mossy crags. And I remember once finding out that the crystal quartz points came from the mountains. And before we set off, I was like, please, mountain. I really want to connect with it. I was really young. I can't even remember how old I was. And we were climbing up over this extremely steep bit of a mountain, and poking out from in amongst the sort of peaty moss was the point of a quartz crystal. I've never found a quartz point since or before or anything, but right there in that moment was a quartz point that came out of the earth. And I just felt like I'd spoken to the mountain. And this kind of journey led, when I was about 15, I found plants. I got a job. My friend's mum opened a franchise of Neil's Yard Remedies in Newcastle, and she invited me to come and work there because I'd already had jobs since I was 13. And out of everything that was there, it was the herbs that really spoke to me. And she took me on a course from Newcastle to Dorset, which is where I now live. to their apothecary garden at Springhead. And there I did a week-long course in herbalism taught by the amazing Chanchal Cabrera. And I just fell in love with her and was like, wow, you can actually do this as a job. I didn't even realize that herbalism was a thing. And it just set my trajectory. And alongside that, I was, you know, exploring altered states of consciousness and going to parties and dancing to repetitive beats and finding myself out in the middle of nowhere with, you know, people inevitably needing support and help. And as soon, I'm sure many of you know this, as soon as you get an interest in plants, people start coming asking for help and support. So I really felt like I was able to explore that calling in a way, in a really in the field kind of experiential way.
B, before you carry on, you must tell everybody what you're wearing on your head.
Oh, so I'm Bramble. I'm a proper hardy brute. And I'm on a takeover mission of this land. And a lot of you forget about me. You'll go out picking brambles from the hedgerow. But, you know, you'll go down the shop and buy these exotic fruits. And I'm there. I'm just there with the kettle on. Whenever you need a cuppa, you can come on over, pick a fruit, get yourself better with me. And I hang out there with my brothers and sisters in the hedgerow. So if you ever need a cup of tea and a chat, I'll be there for you.
Okay, I now know what happens when I ask what you're going to, what hat you're wearing. Okay, wow.
Not just a hat.
No, it's your channeling. Fantastic. Kaz, what was your childhood like? Similar, dissimilar?
It was different. It was different. My mum's Czech, my dad's Austrian. I have Jewish heritage. My family came as refugees. My mum came during the 60s when the Russian tanks entered Prague and the Velvet Revolution was quashed. And my connection to plants, because of that, it's very normalised in Czechoslovakia then, or the Czech Republic, and in Hungary and Austria. People have herbs as part of their normal tea rituals. So where we have the PG tips or the tetli with the milk and sugar, it's a lot more common there to be drinking various different herbs. So my grandmother's brought me up because my parents were working, and herbs were part of everyday existence and life.
Where were you living?
North London. So the borough of Barnet is where I spent my early years, and I loved it in Barnet. I loved tapping into the history, and I absolutely love London. I was born in centre London within the sound of Bow Bells, and I have a deep connection with the city. I love the history. I love the river. And I'm still quite close to London now.
So what in your childhood or teen years was taking you into a kind of deeper rapport with herbs?
Well, the deeper rapport, my teens got smashed. I had a very nihilistic, I discovered all kinds of different drugs and alcohols by the time I was 13. And I ran away from home, literally with a circus of sound systems and travellers, and lived on the road for many, many years. And living on traveller sites with lots of different people who were seeking an alternative way of living, because the status quo and the politics of the time were just awful. Feeling, you know, when you're a teenager, you feel everything. You've got so much more intensity of feeling. And I was just absolutely horrified and full of rage. And I turned that in on myself in a lot of ways. So being part of a community of people and seeing where the need was. So, for example, I became the place where all of the brew heads came. So everyone that was addicted to Tennent Super, or at the time Special Brew, when they didn't have the money to buy their alcohol, used to come and get valerian from me, because I knew that the valerian really helped with the DTs, the shakes and the problems. And I was going in to Neil's yard and shoplifting Solgar's valerian at the time, to the point where I had, I was able to give it out on site.
How old were you?
I was about 17 then.
Okay, so you both of you were kind of teenage hooligans.
Ah, the word hooligan.
Hooligan. That's a good word, isn't it?
It is a good word. I'm trying to, what's the, yeah. What's it come from with the hooligans? We like to have a loo.
I say it with affection and support, actually. So where did you both go from the circumstances you've just described into the herbalism school, or when did you meet and how did you meet?
So we met on the herbal medicine degree, which was a full-time 4-year degree in North London at Middlesex University. Oh,
let me pause you for a second. This is quite a jump from a kind of traveller convoy to a university degree, and it's quite a jump too from a crystal sticking out of a mountain saying hello to you to also to a 4-year degree. So what there must have been a kind of a calling, a sniff of something, a bridge between that took you into uni. What happened?
Yeah. I mean, alongside all of the kind of wayward nihilism that was going on, I was still in Newcastle doing A levels, and it was actively encouraged to go to university within my family. My mum was first generation from the slums of South Shields, had got herself an education and had actually been ostracised by her mum for getting an education. She had to leave her family, essentially. So for her, to be able to have her children go to university was one of her main aims. But when I came back from being in Dorset and said, apparently you can do this thing, it's a degree in medical herbalism, my mum was just like, that's way too vocational. You can't choose one profession at the age of 15, 16, and that be that. Like, and I was like, no, absolutely. This is it. This is all I'm doing with my life. And I know what's happening. And I set about then. I was in college, and college I was failing. I'd gone from, you know, high GCSEs to being predicted failing at college. So I took 1 year where I was like, right, I need biology. I was doing maths, art, biology for A level. That's what I switched to. Just about scraped my A levels in a year that I needed to get on that course, because there was no way I was doing another year of A-levels. I absolutely abhorred the education system that I was in. It was just a means to an end for me. And in fact, I don't even think I finished the night class at college in biology, because there just wasn't time. But I meanwhile went and started visiting the unis that offered the course. And back then, there was quite a lot of universities offered medical herbalism. Well, there were several. So I did a bit of a recce of them, and actually Middlesex that I ended up going to, or that we both ended up going to, was the kind of drabbest. It was like a sort of 60s ex-polytechnic in Ponders End in London, surrounded by sort of grey buildings with the odd chicken shop and a Tesco's, but not a lot else going on there. But the atmosphere and the feeling of the uni, for some reason, just made me feel like this is where I want to be. It was almost like that's the one. And I put that as my preference, even though, you know, compared to some of the other facilities and the universities, it felt like the most kind of rundown pit to go to.
And you got the A levels you needed.
Well, I don't even think I did. I can't even remember, but they let me in.
They let you in, yay.
Yeah, and I was just like, brilliant, this is it. I'd gone for a visit down with a friend. We just ended up getting really drunk in their refectory, and I just thought this is great. And they had a tiny little herb garden at the back of the uni, and I think that was a really big draw, because that was like a sanctuary. There was nothing else there but this lovely man, Peter, that ran the herb garden, and we could just go and work in the herb garden between sessions. And yeah, so and then I took a year out. I went traveling. I went to India. I traveled all over, and then I came back and had that place set.
Okay, thank you. So Kaz,
mm-hmm.
you're on the road.
I'm on the road.
Did they let you in as well without any A-levels, as a kind of access type thing, or what happened?
Access course. I lived in Spain. We moved out of England when the criminal justice bill hit in the kind of mid-90s, and we were travelling in Spain, and I ended up living with a herbalist there on her land, and making lots of different remedies and products. And I went to a party, met a friend, and she said, oh, I'm doing this degree at Middlesex. I went straight back. I got myself housed in a council flat 20 minutes away from the university, and I had a son by then, Harry. And
you had a Middlesex, the gatekeeper at Middlesex Uni for your particular course was actually fairly knowing about who he was going to let in.
The gatekeeper at Middlesex University.
Yeah, it must have been just to let you both in.
Yeah,
they let us in.
I understand. I totally understand, because there was a time when bureaucracy did not completely control university admissions.
Yeah,
and tutors could let folk in based on talent. I got into the London School of Economics without A levels based on that.
Yeah, no, you're right, because I thought when I, you know, I got a maths and an art A-level, when I realised I didn't have it, I was like, oh, I'm never going to, and I rang up and I had a place and didn't expect it. No, you're right, they let us in.
So listen, you two then met, and I've got to say that you must have been asked this before, it's bubbling in me. Let's just take it as a metaphor, not as, we don't actually have to believe in it, but as a metaphor. What was the past life connections that brought you together and into this cauldron of working together and your practice? You must have, at one level or another, call it a metaphor, so we don't have to get into whether past lives are real or not. But as a metaphor, what have you explored?
We've actually travelled back in time. twice we've travelled back in time and seen what's happened. Once was on Hitchin Market when we were trading together on a stall there. And another time was at a festival. Again, it actually was at Hitchin both times, wasn't it? Was it the, what's Rhythms. The festival? The Rhythms of the Work.
So you have a strong connection that goes back.
We've spoken.
Yeah, it was like
sisters. Well.
Okay, sisters. But the connection must also include a deep history of being traditionally connected with the herbs of this landscape, because you seem to have a playful, joyful, very knowledgeable rapport with what works and what doesn't work.
Yeah, it felt like it felt like we've almost walked in these shoes before together. Is the experience that we've had with it. And Kaz is definitely big sister, and I am definitely little sister, and that's the sort of dynamic that we play out. But the traveling back in time felt very much about the this role that we're in now has been a role that has always been, and that there was this this moment in time when herbalism was trying to be almost dragged into a new arena and into a new way of being. And we were really on that cusp with the way we were being trained. And there was something very interesting that happened, that we were being trained in this medicalized way in herbal medicine, which is, you know, it was especially then was a quite an on the edge thing. There was, people didn't even know what a herbalist was. I mean, I didn't until I met Chanchal Cabrera. You know, I wasn't brought up knowing what a herbalist was. I was given plants as a child. You know, my mum would brew me ginger in milk and things a lot to help soothe me. But it never as a profession was it known about. And at that time, the university degrees were trying to professionalize medical herbalism to be potentially, you know, put into a register, statutory register, with the government. So there was this big sort of pulling towards making it a registered profession.
So let's stay with that then for the moment. So Kaz, that movement, which in one sense is sensible, because you don't want amateurs giving people poison, and you don't want snake oil out there. So at one level, getting it regulated might be useful if the people who are doing the regulation know what they're doing. Yes, no? Where are you at on this?
I was always like dead set against any kind of regulation. I'm an anarchist, and I definitely don't want to be told what to do by politicians and government officials. So I would never adhere to that. For me, I self-govern, and I know that what I'm doing is for the benefit of life.
Let me push back a little bit on that, just to get clarity, right? Yeah. Because we know that there are people without any wisdom, knowledge, or training, yeah, who will recommend herbs without any knowledge about what they may or may not be doing.
Yeah.
And those folk need to be guided.
Yes. And all through human history, there's always been people that are the charlatans. Yeah. There's always been people that are focused on their own ends rather than the benefit of life. But that's not my personal where I want to look, nor where I want to put my responsibility. I want to put my responsibility in working the way that I feel is right and modelling that. And that's not a big society thing. I don't want to be in government or governance. I just work with grassroots, and that's the way that we have been doing it.
This is really interesting. Let's just tease this one out a bit. Because you have students,
yeah,
who you teach and approve of, certificate or graduate in some way or another. So you are regulating them.
Well, the whole thing about certification was something that we fought for a very long time, because in my belief system, it's a load of rubbish having a certificate. That's my belief. And I say that to our students. And we say, this is a pretty piece of paper.
Yeah, I agree. Burn the certificates. I agree. Nevertheless, you've got folk you've trained going out into the world saying they've been trained by you.
And the training is just for them to understand how to work. Okay. We've shown them with their friends and family.
The reason I'm really interested, and I want everybody who's listening to get the right picture, because if you read your books, which I have, and you look at your videos, you're very rigorous. Mm. You're absolutely on it in terms of what the different herbs do, how they should be administered, where the health and safety stuff comes in. You're hot on safeguarding, all of that stuff, right? So It's interesting that that's within a kind of a political attitude that's more anarchic.
Yeah,
But you're very rigorous in the middle of it.
Yeah, because the most important thing is that each person is self-responsible. You know, that's the bit, and that's what we try to have conversations with students about.
Yeah.
You're responsible for your own understanding of abilities. You know, people can go and get degrees in medicine and herbal medicine and still not be safe, not be oat safe. So I don't have an illusion that we have any power to make people safe. And I think that's where it is. That isn't my illusion.
We actually, the purpose of the work that we do is to actually try and shift the paradigm of society rather than the people purveying the herbs. Because the problem with, you know, the charlatans or the, you know, any form of spirituality or medicine or anything where people are putting it out there, we believe is to do with the discernment of the people that are buying into that. And because there's this like complete lack of knowledge or understanding, or certainly that started to shift, but certainly back around the 2000s, there was such a little understanding of what a herbalist was that, you know, people were going into Holland and Barrett and saying, I've got Crohn's disease, have you got anything? And people were going, yeah, here's something off the shelf. And that to us was, you know, almost the same as taking a medication without understanding what's going on at a deeper level, where that plant's come from, who's grown that plant, what other plants has that plant seen. And all we're doing on our courses is saying, start with the connection with the plant. You know, we would never say, give a herb to anyone or take a herb that yourself that you don't know what it looks like. You haven't smelt it growing in the ground. You know, what is that plant? And that's where the connection starts. And that's how we start with our students. And anything that we're teaching them how to pass on snippets of knowledge, but we're not teaching them to have some power over healing others. And we tried running a 3-year course once, just in our drop combinations of herbs that we make, so not even into the wider world of medical herbalism. And it was really lovely, the journey that people were going on and the transformative power of these 3 years of study. But every person that came out of that, we realized we had to mentor them and support them. And it was, you know, it wasn't, we couldn't manage that with more than, I don't know, we had 10 graduates.
I almost want to apologize for taking us down this particular conversation, because I'm pretty sure that's not what people who are watching, listening, want us to be talking about. But it's so everybody watching, I'm sorry if I took us down a rabbit hole. forgive me. Let's steer back to attuning and being in relationship with the actual plants. So you, Fi, had the mountain talk to you through the crystal suddenly emerging to you. And I'm sorry, Kaz, I find it very beautiful and wonderful that you were nicking stuff from Neil's yard to help people who had addiction problems, right? I think that touches my heart. Now, if somebody watching this asks, well, listen, I've not done this before, I've not attuned to a plant, how do I do that? And are you saying that plants are also like nature spirits, fairies, elves? Do you want to just talk us through this a bit?
So plants are my family, my ancestors, my friends, some of my closest, funniest, most supportive friends are plants. And one way that I find really helpful to connect with plants is having space and time. So I'm not in a rush or a hurry. And I let myself be, whether it's in a park or a garden or even just having a pot plant close to me. I like to open my senses, and this is the way that Fee and I have been working with people and why we're called sensory solutions. Because the way plants communicate, and we can use words like nature spirits or fairies and elves, but I actually see plants as different from fairies. I've experienced fairies living within certain plants that I haven't found in other plants, but the plants themselves I see as very much embodied in their structure. And by opening our senses to plants and fully tapping into observation, and we always say to people, it's like being a detective, and you're just using all of your powers of observation and as keenly and acutely as possible, sensing this other being. And we get this information by the colour of the plant, the shape of the plant, the smell, the taste, the feel of the plant that comes to us. And what Fiona and I have done by doing this very rigorous scientific degree is learn a language that can be overlaid with the sensory language. So we can explain these observations, these sensations in scientific terms. Like, for example, when we taste, when we drink a herbal tea or you nibble a leaf, and the flavours of that plant begin to commune with us. So there might be something sweet or salty or bitter or very, very floral and perfumed. And each one of those different tastes is describing, or is another word, is a translation for one of the chemical constituents within the plant. And this dialogue that we can have with the plants informs us on lots of different levels, but on a very practical level, it informs us one way of taking good care of ourselves. And by Fee and I learning this language with the plants is how we came out of that nihilistic period. And, you know, we'd been pretty battered and bruised and hurt our bodies from excessive drugs and alcohol and being in the wrong company. And the plants were able to give us amazing medicine and amazing support to nourish our organs, to come through various different illnesses that we were suffering from. And, you know, that in turn, the plants have this message of they're incredibly generous. Not all of them, but there's a lot of plants that are very generous and grow abundantly. And there's a message there to pass on that information.
So the message is communicated partly through taste. And I'm going to use the language from another field, mindfully being present to the different bits of the taste. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's one of the beautiful things about the plants is that, yes, you can break them down to those component constituents, but, you know, they're full of different plant compounds. So you can get a drying sensation, but also, you know, a moistening or a softening or an increase of saliva. So you can have these seemingly opposite sensations and experiences within your mouth that all inform either what the actions of the plant can be, but then still more than that, how they can interact on a more psycho-emotional, spiritual level. And even the physical actions of the plants can give you clues as to how they might support you in a more emotional way. Kaz mentioned the taste of bitter, which if you get that bitter taste, you'll start preparing your digestive system for food. So bitter herbs generally, you know, are going to have some effect on the digestion. But also that feeling of bitterness and that experience of bitterness, it stimulates change, it stimulates movement and a shift within the body. And if you want to work energetically to create shift and change, if someone's feeling very stuck in a pattern or just generally in their life, it might be a bitter herb that you would therefore reach on for that individual to work with.
So as a practitioner, you're asking folk to be very embodied, sensuously aware of what's going on in themselves in response to the different elements of taste, smell, colour, and then what's happening in your own body.
Yes, we're focused on connection. You know, the thing that drives us is this wish to reconnect to people. You know, there's a narrative that we're also disconnected from nature, but our bodies are nature. You know, we're partly nature. we're in a whole. We're all part of the same thing. So without having an intimate understanding of your own self and your own sensations, it's very, very difficult to have connection to other beings, especially different species. So you know, I mentioned about space and time. The most important thing that we work with people is creating this space and time to be quiet in nature and to be on your own with plants.
Okay, so we've got now a kind of spectrum of experience and practice up your end. There's someone who can go deep into the relational experience of the essence of a plant and how your own body responds to it. And then you've got folk who are learning or being coached by you into how to do that for themselves. And then you've got the herb itself, which can act on it all on its own. You know, just plonk it in someone's body and their body, give somebody valerian and it will chill them out, maybe, you know. Mm-hmm. So we've got a spectrum of experience here. What I'm noticing as you talk about it is the global spiritual movement over the last two decades, which is to get people into their bodies and feeling their emotions, the sensuous experience of mood change, and all the rest of it. And you're coming in on, I think, that same wave of, oi, folks, being spiritual, doing personal development is not about spacing out. It's not intellectual. It's about actually sinking down into your body and noticing what's going on in its relationships. And yours is very directly bridging folk into nature, Mother Nature, and the world our bodies come out of.
We do. That's the most important bit for us. But we do bring in the intellectualizing. We call it the interpretation. So this is more about people that want to connect with herbs in order to then work with plants, with others, with themselves or with their family. But we always say, you know, you can have this lovely experience sitting under a willow tree for the day and, you know, connecting completely with the willow, maybe tasting some of the leaves, you know, being in that experience, that sensual experience. But how are you going to interpret your experiences then into something helpful that you can take out into the world? And that's the bit where the intellectualizing might come in, which is the point where we would then say, you know, write down your feelings, your experiences, whatever it was, and then look at how to interpret that. So then maybe go to books and see what others have said about Willow, and what scientific papers have been written about Willow, and see if you can draw parallels between what other people are saying and what your experience was. And at that point, people can, it's like a practice then, people can almost learn much more quickly how to interpret the information that comes through that sensual experience, you know, that might take less of that interpretation in the future. But there's that point where you're actually, what comes out of it is something helpful and useful for you to be able to work with.
You know, at the very beginning when I introduced you, I said what was unusual about you was the rigor of your approach. And what I'm hearing you describe here is an intellectual reflective practice, so that the left brain in particular is allowed to fully engage with the healing and developmental process, and at the same time understand that it's in relationship with the plant world, which is sensuous. So we've got sensuous relationship, we've got reflective intellectual awareness, research, curiosity. I love the word curiosity in this context.
Weird, yeah.
And there's the other element now, which is there are subtle energies, and we have subtle energy abilities. And how are you integrating that into the hackage that you're describing?
Well, we, you know, as soon as we met, we set up study groups together. And the study groups were normally held around the moons, and we were making spells and creating rites and rituals and working magically. So the magic, the subtle energies, the vibrations, we often say the plants lead us, the plants have guided us to what we do. And it's very true that by observing the moons, by observing this rhythm that's constant in our life, the expansion and contraction, and holding space for ritual. And at the beginning, when we began practicing together, Harry, my son, was about 2 or 3, and he led the rituals. He was up and about. Children absolutely loved candles and ribbons, and we just let him choose and dictate, and everything was made up as we went along, because neither of us are particularly good with rules and structure imposed by others unless we fully understand why. So we created our own rules and structures, and a lot of the time let the children lead. And the subtle energies that come through the dream space, through working magically, you know, sometimes, like Fee mentioned earlier, the quartz crystal, sometimes we want to work with a particular plant and that plant is nowhere to be found, and an incantation and a candle and an invocation, and suddenly that plant's all around. And did we just not notice it, or did it turn up because called?
What do you mean the plant's suddenly around? It's there physically, or you sense it's there?
Yeah, it's there physically. We've walked sites before knowing we need plantain because we're going to make a preparation group. There's no plantain anywhere. So that becomes a frustration. So instead of, or the moment of the frustration, we've done a bit of magic on the hoof, we like to call it. And then there's plantain.
So, where do you put into your holistic map the subtle energetic vibration that's with a flower essence or homeopathic remedies? Do these fit in your map?
Yes, we create flower essences and have worked with homeopaths.
So in the context of your intellectual rigor,
in the context of the intellectual rigor,
how do you describe that stuff?
Vibrations. So yeah. I describe it as a vibrational wave. I know that water holds memory and that we're made up of vibrations, and I've felt the impact. And for me, it's more about the person creating the vibrational wave than how it's packaged. It's about the person that creates it.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because we talk about the difference between homeopathy or a flower essence and herbal medicine. Is this kind of direct interface with the tastes, the flavors, the physical plant versus those subtle energetics? But it doesn't remove the subtle energetics from the herbal medicine. It's just that you have this direct interface there, but all that does really is give you clues as to what's going on with those energetics. When I talked about the physical actions of the plants giving an indication as to the more subtle energetics, that's kind of how we overlay it. But that doesn't mean we don't work with flower essences. We do, but we also work with tiny drop doses of a herbal medicine preparation, because these subtle hormonal neurological shifts that can occur with even just a drop dose that, you know, your British National Formulary would say there's no way there's enough dosage in that dose to have the physiological changes, yet you see profound changes when people take one drop of a plantain tincture, for example, as Kaz mentioned before. And
I think it's important to say here that these tinctures are fresh. So we're using fresh herb. And in the fresh herb that's vital and full of water, you get a very different type of tincture than if you were to use a dried herb. And we were lucky to have a look at some high liquid chromatography, and you put the tincture in a spinning machine and then it's all kind of sprayed along a particular type of paper that picks out the different colours. And when you look at that with a fresh herb tincture, you get a spectrum of colour, because all of the vibrational frequencies in that herb are coming out, so you can actually physically see it, that you don't get with a dried herb tincture. And I guess that's what I meant there when I said I know water has a memory, because I've seen it physically changing that paper. And so it's a lot about, you know, you were saying, where is it on the map? How do we intellectualize? It took me a moment, but that's how.
Yeah. I mean, because I mean, the kaleidoscope, the constellation of stuff that's involved in what we're talking about is, it's very complex and it's very intriguing. And I'm going to throw in a little grenade here.
so I'm ready to catch it.
So yeah, catch pan and nature spirits, right? All across the world, globe, in different forms, pan emerges in a form that's appropriate to local culture. And so do nature spirits. They emerge in forms of, according to the appropriate culture. And they're usually associated with certain areas of landscape and also of particular plants. And there's one concept I like, which is if the physicality of the plant melted away and you were just left with its energy field, that energy field of the plant, just like everything is alive, is a thing that's alive in its own right. So that it's one way of looking at what a nature spirit might be. It's the energy of the plant, but the physical plant's not there. And then you've got man. So where does all that, does that come into your mapping at all? If so, how?
Yeah, so we do something which is personify that energy that's left. And we understand that that energy isn't a physical human form, but the idea of the reality of nature spirits, of energy being represented historically across the world as deities, as these figures, as Pan, to encompass a broad spectrum of different experiences, expressions of emotion, rather than just simplifying things down to, I mean, these terms masculine and feminine that are just bandied about at the minute. That's a personal thing for me at the minute, is about being more subtle or descriptive with what we mean by that. And we personify the, having cat issues, we personify those energetics to help others to learn and understand that energy. And that's what these characters are about, that we bring is this is our experience of working with these plants. And what they bring forward is these bright, colourful, or sometimes very stoic and or very calm characters that we can really explore playing with and bringing new folklore into the world that has a bit of a relevant modern twist sometimes, that can bring us joy and bring forward our connections with the plants through that more oral tradition and theatre and performance. But it's because of the essence of what you're talking about, I think, that the shedding away of everything else and just seeing the plant for what it truly is, that enables us to kind of think, right, we'll carry that forwards for you, we'll carry that out in the world. But we're under no illusion that the plants need us or that we're important in any way to the plants in that sense. But this idea that we are truly part of nature. And I had an experience once where I understood, suddenly in that moment, I could understand the perception of like a butterfly to a plant or a plant to another plant, and that it's not visual in the same way that we see it, but it is exactly that, this energetic experience of how it's perceived. And, you know, in that moment, it was like, yeah, we're just part of this, looking in on it, but it's not that we're needed to see it.
You've given me a gift, actually. It's something I will do as a result of this conversation, which is and I'm hoping this is relevant to the people who are listening as well, is the next time I am with a plant, any plant that I like or I feel some kind of rapport with, I will pause and imagine me becoming a costume that's appropriate for a dance with this plant and do some kind of dance awareness thingy with it, which leads me then to Kaz. You've got to tell everybody why you're wearing what you're wearing, because presumably that's a manifestation of you choosing to theatrically, sacred theatre, manifest how you relate to a what's going on.
Yes, well, good evening. I am Apple, and I'm a little bit upset because I've been called Malus Domestica, which is domesticated evil. So that's the name that I carry in all of the botany books that have been written about me. And the whole weight of original sin has been dumped on my shoulders. But tomorrow night we're going to wassail in our lovely community orchard, and wassail is good fortune, it's good health, and a bit of me every single day keeps that doctor away. And we've really enjoyed, you know, I really enjoy bringing these characters in, and you said modern day folklore, and sometimes we can't remember facts about plants. You know, if you read something, you've got all these facts about the actions and the constituents. But we do remember the stories. We do remember the way we learn through story. And it's just been wonderful for us to watch year upon year of students, because we tell our students that the last weekend we're together on our apprenticeship, they're going to embody a plant and they're going to come in costume. So we've watched hundreds of people dress up as plants and speak and channel the plants, which is a real privilege, and it's really exciting.
And then we certificate them for it.
All right, yeah, hoist on my own petard. I surrender. I've lost. But I watched a video of you yesterday, the two of you, talking about, what's the fly allergic, the mushroom?
Fly agaric.
And the both of you were in red spotted outfits, reflecting the, psychedelically reflecting the psychedelia of the particular mushroom. So listen, as we move towards the end of this conversation, where are you guys at with the current emergence over the last decade, and increasingly so, of plant medicine psychedelics being used in clinical and non-clinical settings? Go ahead.
I'll just say quickly, we're both allergic to certain words.
Okay.
We're allergic to shaman. We're allergic to cacao ceremony. We have reactions to quite a lot of marketing and commodifying and consumerism around it. So it depends, you know. But we've been working with a community of psychiatrists.
I don't think that was the question.
It definitely was. I heard it there. There's a resurgence of psychedelic medicine, and coming alongside that has been cultural appropriation and people suddenly doing weekend trainings and not understanding where the word shaman or shaman even comes from, practicing medicine from Peru when they're from Basingstoke. And it's all a little bit much.
All right. Eight out of 10 for your rant.
Only eight?
Okay, 10 out of 10. 10 out of 10 for your rant. Right? Moving on. Right? You think it's good? It seems good-ish, apart from the commercialization and the charlatans, which push them to the side, right?
It's like anything, isn't it? There's two opinions, and it's just yet to be seen. So one is that it's brilliant that, you know, psychedelic medicine or the idea of shifting your consciousness is not a dodgy evil for reprobates and weirdos, that it's actually something that can be seen as beneficial and helpful in a healing modality. You know, brilliant. It's in The Guardian, and people are reading about it and hearing about it, and it can create a shift. And then there's also, you know, psychedelic compounds are therefore coming into the arena in a controlled manner. And it's, you know, and they're still illegal it's still illegal to alter your own consciousness.
I'll tell you what, I think I'm now in putting on you the mantle of you are the spokespeople for Gaia, right? I'm now making, and you are now the spokespeople for Mother Nature, right? Do you give a thumbs up to the use of magic mushroom medicine, psychedelics in general coming? Do you think it's part of a wave that will be good over the decades to come?
As a spokesperson for Mother Nature, I love magic mushrooms. I enjoy taking magic mushrooms and drinking them and crawling around in fields, eating them with the sheep. And I will continue to take magic mushrooms as often as I possibly can and share them with my community and family. I don't know about the rest of the world.
Okay.
That's the truth.
Thank you. And younger sister, how do you...
we do that a lot together, continuously throughout our lives.
As part of your research.
It will be a thread, yeah, as part of our own personal...
Recreation.
As part of our own engagement with Gaia.
Okay. So listen, I don't want anybody watching this to be misled by flippancy around stuff that can be dangerous, right? So going back 30 years ago, I was at a consciousness conference once, an academic consciousness conference, mm-hmm. and there were researchers, professors from around the world, and one of them got up, I think it was from Brighton, from Sussex Uni, and said, look, if you want to study consciousness, you do need to take mescaline or LSD in order to experience consciousness in its different forms. So there's a very serious aspect here to consciousness exploration using psychedelics, which is different from recreational.
The word recreation has actually become had negative connotations, but when the word recreation first came into use in the 1400s, it meant to restore, to revive,
to recreate.
To recreate, and it sounds flippant, but that's the term that we're using it within, because we don't even approach drinking nettle tea in an annihilistic way, because you can drink too much nettle tea and it will burn your system out because it's so heating. Some people can't drink nettle tea for 3 days without overheating their system. So when we're saying that, it's about coming together. We don't take huge doses of anything, because the less you do of certain things, the less you need. Just generally, that what we're talking about, getting into those tastes and those flavors, you need a tiny amount. Even we've given people drops of elderflower and plantain tincture in a nightclub because it's the only drops that we had, and we call them earth clarity for clearing your mind and keeping your feet on the ground, plantain for grounding, elderflower for clearing the mind. We use it for hay fever, we use it for fuzzy headedness. We were giving drops to people in a club and they were coming back up just going, what was that? Can I have another drop? That was the most amazing thing I've ever taken. Because they were getting into this historical tapping into the consciousness of those plants and being blown away by it in that setting. And that to us was like, this is really powerful. Is those subtle energies that you're talking about of the plants can be applied across the board, but that we don't want to fear or think that there's anything wrong with playing, dancing, connecting with each other. And that to us, it does bring joy, and it does bring recreation, as in a sense of feeling well.
This again, this conversation has done a very unusual spiral dance, hasn't it? It's gone from, goes from weird to being quite compassionately rigorous back to weird again, quite compassionately rigorous. And it's very unusual. And I really admire you both for that. Makes me feel a little bit, makes me feel as though I'm being a bit flippant when I don't mean to be. And I'm grateful for that process. As we come to an end, is there anything the two of you would like to share as a blessing, as an insight?
I'd like to share something that I only learned this week, but I think it's really special. Whenever we lose anything, we've always lit a candle to St. Anthony, and it's a ritual that's been around as long as I can remember, and it's something I've passed on to all of my family and friends. And I learned this, I wondered why, and I learned from my teenager that St. Anthony was born in Portugal and made his way to Italy in the 1200s, Antonio. And in Italy, he became unwell with ergot poisoning, along with a lot of the community there. So ergot is a fungus that commonly grows on rye, and then when the bread was made, people ingesting the ergot would have visions and hallucinations. And LSD has been synthesized from ergot. And St. Anthony was famed for giving a sermon to the fish. And this term that he was the patron saint of lost souls, of others who were also suffering from these visions and hallucinations, was something that I learned. And it brings me some comfort. You know, we have been talking around psychedelics. We haven't gone very deep into it. And there's something about being silly and being playful and not taking anything too seriously that is very important. The academic rigor and the thought process, the reflection and the intellectualizing is all part of it. But there's always a flip point where we like to get a bit lost and act a bit lost it. So that's what I wanted to share.
Oh, thank you. That dug me out of my hole. Thank you. I'm grateful. Hey, is there anything you'd like to say as a final blessing?
Yeah, to I think as Bramble, as a Geordie Bramble, not to forget the riches that are on the doorstep in this melting pot of worldwide connections that we have even tonight now. But yeah, what's on the doorstep? And I know many of us here will already be doing that, but next time you look at a bramble, just think she's there waiting with her kettle on if you need to have a chat and a brew.
All right. I have many brambles in the back garden. We've reframed my relationship with them. So, people, you highly recommend this book and their other book. I think you have a taste here, people who are listening, of the work and the approach that these two extraordinary, unusual, wonderful people do. Seed Sisters, the website is seedsisters.co.uk. And to the two of you, blessings and many, many thanks.
Thank